So we've been doing a series on Genja Koan. This is talk number two. Genja Koan is a sort of summary or a concise statement of Zen practice as written by Dogen, who was a great Zen master in around the year 1200. That's when he was born. It's also in the liturgy book, I think page 25, if you wanted to follow along, but you don't need to. So I'll read the part that we've already gone over, and then we'll come up to what I'm going to talk about tonight. As all things are Buddha Dharma, there is delusion and realization, practice and birth and death, and there are Buddhas and sentient beings. As the myriads are without self, there is no delusion, no realization, no Buddha, no sentient being, no birth and death. The Buddha way is basically leaping clear of the many and the one. Thus there are birth and death, delusion and realization, sentient beings and Buddhas. Yet in attachment, blossoms fall, and in aversion, weeds spread. To carry yourself forward and experience myriad things is delusion. That myriad things come forth and experience themselves is awakening. Those who have great realization of delusion are Buddhas. Those who are greatly deluded about realization are sentient beings. Further, there are those who continue realizing beyond realization, who are in delusion throughout delusion. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they do not necessarily notice that they are Buddhas. However, they are actualized Buddhas who go on actualizing Buddhas. So this is how far we had gotten in the last talk. So I'll read the next paragraph. When you see forms or hear sounds fully engaging body and mind, you grasp things directly. Unlike things and their reflections in the mirror, and unlike the moon and its reflection in the water, when one side is illumined, the other side is dark. So when you see forms or hear sounds fully engaging body and mind, you grasp things directly. And this is what we do when we sit in Zazen. We are not putting anything between us and what we experience. I don't know about grasping things directly. We experience them directly. So a sound arises, we hear it. Sound hearing, not even necessarily a we to hear it, but just there's a sound. This is understanding directly, grasping directly. Don't need any thought about that. Don't need to analyze it. It simply arises. There it is, the sound. And now I'm throwing a whole lot of words about it afterwards. But not necessary. Already grasped directly. And then this next statement has often given me reason to scratch my head in perplexity. So I will give you how I understand it. But that's certainly not the last word on Dogen. I don't know that there's ever a last word on Dogen. Unlike things and their reflections in the mirror, and unlike the moon and its reflection in the water, when one side is illumined, the other side is dark. So the moon and shining in the water is an often used Zen metaphor for truth, and then how truth is manifested in this world, through us and in the things of the world. So we have the absolute side, which is the moon and shining. And then we have the relative side, which is its reflection in the water. Mm-hmm. So my understanding of this is that Dogen's saying, although we can see both the moon and its reflection at the same time, when we're talking about the actual moon and water, in our own lives, when we're dealing with the world of form and the absolute, they're one and the same. They're two different ways of looking at our world through the filter or lens of the absolute way of perceiving, or as we usually see it, the world of form, of this and that, self and other. And there's not a way to see both of those at once. We can't combine them and say, here it all is in one big package. We can sometimes notice the world as it comes forth as self and other, as form, as this and that. And sometimes we can notice everything as one, and we can experience it in that way. But I don't think it's possible for us as humans to have both of those perceptions at the same time. So that is, when one side is illumined, the other side is dark. And this is Dogen simply expressing what his experience has been. And then the next paragraph is really the heart of the whole Genjo Koan. And if one were to hear nothing else, this would be enough. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. So let's look at this a little at a time. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. So we all have our varying reasons why we come and try Zazen, what draws us here. Some people are simply curious, and some have events that have happened to them of loss or sorrow that drive them to want to understand, all different reasons. But it all comes down to, so we're pointed to studying the Buddha way. We think that this is what we're coming to do, as though it were something quite apart from ourselves. You know, that here am I, such as I am, you know, this big mess, and then the Buddha way is some other thing. It makes me think of the 10 ox herding pictures. I don't know if you've ever seen them. We have them hanging up in the Greater Boston Zen Center as scrolls, 10 scrolls. And they're pictures generally shown inside a circle, 10 circles. And they're supposed to represent the a spiritual journey, what we do as we practice Zen Buddhism. And the very first one shows a boy parting the grasses looking for the ox. The ox is his Buddha nature. So they're the ox herding pictures. As it goes along, he finds the ox and tames the ox and so forth. The ox disappears, and then, well, anyway, but the first one is the boy looking for the ox. The ox is out there somewhere, hidden, doesn't know where. So this is to study the Buddha way. It's to study the self, rather than thinking that it's out there somewhere and that we have to go and find it. We turn inward. It is actually studying the self. Where else could it be? Truth cannot be hidden from us, as if it were something that we could add on. If that were the case, we could also lose it. And then what good is it? We'd always have to be worried about this truth, this realization that we might lose. But it's not so. We've always had it. We just don't realize that that is the case. And so, having been told that, we turn and begin to study the self. This is what we do when we sit in Zazen. The self, in this way, we see that it's composed of nothing that abides. Everything comes and goes. It arises and it passes away. Our self can't be our thoughts, because they come and go. They change all the time. It can't be our moods, our feelings. It can't be the sounds and perceptions. There's really nothing that we find that we can hang on to and say, this is it. So what is it that we're studying? What is this self that we're turning toward? And I want to point out that this is not the kind of study that requires a particular level of intelligence. It's not something that you can do better if you have a higher IQ. In fact, I would say it kind of goes the other way. Mm-hmm. And this comes home to me in particular in a koan. The koans are public cases. They are conversations that occurred a long time ago between a Zen master and a student, or between two monks, and they were recorded because they point the way for us in all different ways, pointing from this way and that. And this particular koan was about a monk, or he became a teacher named Gute. And I suppose he was not a scholarly sort. He was a very simple fellow. This is my imagining from how the koan goes. Gute, I won't tell you the whole story of him, but the thing about him was that no matter what his students asked him, his answer was always this. He held up one finger. And the index finger, not any other. And that was his answer. And it was very simple. You know, this was what he had to offer. He wasn't good with giving long, involved explanations. He wasn't particularly quick with the witty or to the point Zen comebacks, what sounds like repartee to us. But this he could offer, this, and that's all he needed. And his students got it, you know, or maybe they didn't, some of them, I don't know. There is a such thing as skillful means, where for one student, one thing is better than another. But he gave what he had to give, and that's what he gave for all his life, and it was enough.
Was it hard to pick up from the recording?
What's that?
Was it hard to pick up from the recording, his finger showing? I didn't know that happened.
From the recording? I don't think they recorded it back in ancient China. These are very old, very old koans, yes. But you're right, it wouldn't work so well now. No. So for those of you listening, I'm holding up a finger. So to study the Buddha way is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self. That's such a curious thing. You would think that couldn't possibly be the case. But I think we experience it that way more often than we realize, or maybe you have not realized it. I think about times when I'm skiing or involved in some very immediate physical activity like that, maybe playing tennis or basketball, whatever it is that is your mm-hmm. thing that you like to go and do. And I think one reason why we really like to do these things is that they require our immediate attention. We can't be lost in our thoughts, or, you know, wandering off daydreaming. We have to be really paying attention to what's going on right this minute. So there's nothing standing between us and our experience of what we're doing. It's that immediate that we aren't putting words into, and now I'm going to bounce the ball and, you know, it's going to hit the floor, and now I'm going to be holding my hand out here ready to catch it. And, you know, if you think that, it's gone, right? You can only just act. So there's no thought of the self. The self is forgotten. We are just doing, just in the midst of this doing. When we sit in Zazen and study the self, we can also be lost in this doing of not doing, this doing of Zazen, of just sitting. So much so that we let go of our notions of I am sitting, of those cars are going by outside. There's just the sound. There's just the sitting. Self is forgotten. And to forget the self is to be actualized by myriad things. So I used to have a terrible fear that if somehow my self disappeared, which was how I framed it in my mind. You know, to forget the self, it would just somehow be gone. You know, I would not be anymore in the way that I know. And it seemed like a terrifying thing. I used to have actual panic attacks sitting on the cushion for fear that somehow this would sweep over me. And you know, I would be gone, me as I knew it. But it isn't like that at all. It's that everything has the opportunity then to rush in and fill that space that we had been holding off as ourselves. So nothing is lost and everything is gained. When actualized by myriad things, your body and mind, as well as the bodies and minds of others, drop away. No trace of realization remains, and this no trace continues endlessly. So if we say to ourselves, ah, I've had a realization, well, there we are again. Body and mind comes right back. So none of this is permanent, right? If we don't have that realization and then gone for all of time, it might be a moment, it might be a few minutes, it might be, you know, a month, I don't know. I can't say with a definitive statement. But at any rate, no trace of realization remains when that's the case. In that moment, it is certainly endless. Who knows how long a moment is? Who can delineate what its boundaries are? I'll read the next paragraph. When you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs. But Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. When you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. Similarly, if you examine myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So here again, when you first seek Dharma, you imagine you are far away from its environs. There's that little boy searching through the grasses for the ox, thinking that it's got to be out there somewhere, because I don't see it. But Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. So Dogen, as I said in the first talk, Dogen's great question when he began his Zen practice was, if we are already enlightened, why do we have to work so hard? Why do we have to do this practice? So perhaps that's our question as well. Perhaps he states it for us.
Did you get an answer to that question?
Yes, and I asked my teacher once, early on, what was that answer? Thinking, you know, I can have a shortcut here, right? Let's just cut right to the chase. The answer that he came back with after years of studying in China, he was Japanese, but he went to China, made a perilous journey there to study with the teachers, because the only Zen teaching that he could find in Japan was rather corrupt and ritualistic. It didn't speak to his question. So he went to China and he found a famous teacher there and studied with that teacher for a long time. And when he came back, the answer that he had to his question was, my eyes are horizontal, my nose is vertical. More than this.
Yeah, that's what I thought she was going to do.
They are the same answer, really. The finger held up. But maybe you'd want to hold a different finger to that answer. I don't know. But Dharma is already correctly transmitted. You are immediately your original self. This is not something that we can add on, because if that were the case, it could be lost. There's no security there, no we would always have to be protecting whatever it is that we had found and added on. And this is what we already do with everything that we try to use to make us feel better, whether it be power or money or food and drink, drugs, sex, whatever, to hold on to it and not let anybody take it away from us, because we would be miserable without it. We'd be somehow less than ourselves. And if this were true for our Buddha nature as well, then it's just more of the same. So it must be something that's always been with us, hidden in plain sight, as they say, already here. So how do we see it? So he says, when you ride in a boat and watch the shore, you might assume that the shore is moving. But when you keep your eyes closely on the boat, you can see that the boat moves. He's suggesting it's not so much what is here, but in how it's perceived. That there are different ways of perceiving, and that maybe we need to shift that a little bit in order to understand what's really going on. It's not the boat moving. I mean, it's not the shore moving. It's maybe it's the boat. Maybe it's neither. For both, I don't know. Examining myriad things with a confused body and mind, you might suppose that your mind and nature are permanent, that we are this thing, solid point, and that there are all these other things that move all around us. So it puts us as a sort of permanent reference point to the shore that's moving out there. He's suggesting that maybe that's not the case, that as we study ourselves, perhaps we'll want to let go of that assumption, that basic assumption that we've carried with us all our lives, and see if it really is so. Question even that, even what seems most basic to our perception of our life. When you practice intimately and return to where you are, return to where you already are, it will be clear that nothing at all has unchanging self. So, why don't we stop here?